From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Governor Gary Herbert has been around a while. So when he says this year's legislative session was one of the most significant sessions he's seen, it's saying something. There was the ongoing dispute between the governor and the House over Medicaid expansion, but that kind of thing happens all the time. And the budget stuff and the education funding stuff, that wasn't new or surprising. What the governor was probably referring to was the surprise announcement from the Mormon Church that they were putting their weight behind a bill that would provide non-discrimination protections for the state's LGBT community. Didn't necessarily make the bill a slam dunk, although it did pass overwhelmingly, and the governor signed it in a ceremony yesterday. Today in the program, we're talking about this year's legislative session, and there's a lot to talk about. We're live at the Hinckley Institute of Politics after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There was something different about this year's legislative session. The session had its usual ideological disputes, not as many message bills, though plenty to raise the eyebrows and hackles of observers, still the usual stuff. What was so unusual was this moment of bipartisan multicultural celebration as leaders from the state's LGBT community joined leaders from the LDS Church, along with Republicans and Democrats, to cheer the signing of a bill that protected the gay community from discrimination. That bill also included provisions that would safeguard religious liberties, and for now, both sides in that issue seem content, which is saying something. But of course, when you look back on the session, you'll find plenty of controversy, plenty of issues unresolved, like Medicaid expansion, to name just one. We're actually talking about quite a few issues today, as many as we can fit into an hour. We're live in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, talking about the 2015 legislative session. Joining us first on the program is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Greg Hughes. He's the Republican representing District 51 in Draper. He served as Majority Whip before becoming Speaker this year. And Mr. Speaker, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Senator Jim DeBacus is with us, also a Democrat from Salt Lake City's District 2 in the State Senate. He is Minority Caucus Manager. He's been the chair of the Utah Democratic Party as well. And Senator DeBacus, welcome to you.
Pleasure to be here, Doug.
I guess I wanted to begin with something that the governor said yesterday, that the legislative session, I think it was yesterday anyway, he said the legislative session has had more big issues, more controversy, some heavy lifting, but it's one of the biggest sessions, most significant, he seems to be saying, since he's been around. Speaker Hughes, do you think that's true? You think this is, does that resonate with you, that it's one of the most significant?
It sure does. We began this session. We didn't want to call a shot and guarantee anything, but we challenged ourselves to do the hard things, to really tackle. If there's transformational things to do in public policy, it's inherently hard. The easy stuff that was transformational, some other legislature was lucky enough to do that. But if it's good, if it's worth doing, it's inherently difficult. And I thought that we set that tone from the first day, and that's what we were after. And I felt we have much to look at that we left better than we found.
It's your first session as Speaker. What was your particular strategy? I mean, on one hand, you could kind of just sort of lay back a little bit, get the lay of the land, or you could be a little bit more aggressive, a little more bold. I mean, I think some would say you were more bold.
Well, it's my personality. I was the whip for 4 years, for four sessions. And so having the opportunity to really accomplish things, get things done, I saw the potential. When you run for leadership, you get to meet every one of your colleagues in their districts, in their homes. And the leadership of every member of the districts that are represented, I knew going into that session, we had the leadership. We had the ability to do big things. And whether it's justice reform, whether it's our education, our commitment to public education, and what we were able to do there. I'm very proud of the work we did. Transportation, infrastructure funding. We will lead this nation with the initiatives that we were able to pass this year with transportation. It's a big deal. And we started our session with a challenge. It wasn't we're going to get all of this accomplished, but it's we have the firepower to get this done. And I'm very proud to serve in the House and for the work that we did.
Former lawmaker Holly Richardson, she blogs these days about the goings-on at the legislature. She wrote that you are willing to take punches for the body. You were a former boxer, we should point out, for those who don't know.
Not a good one. But.
And they, in return, have your back. Is it true that you're willing to take some punches for the people?
Absolutely. You know, we love to think this is just all policy wonkish things, that we're just down in the deep grass. But there's a pugilism to politics. There's a rough and tumble that comes. And my goal as the Speaker of the House is to say, look, we're going to take on some of these rough issues, but where it's going to get rough, or where colleagues would be attacked for certain positions taken, I was willing to be the tip of the spear, and I was willing to be the one to really represent the sentiment in the House and be that face of that, until we could get to that common ground. Once you get there, we can all join together and accomplish great things. But until then, I was willing to be that person.
Senator Dukakis, what do you make of just general impressions, first of all, the significance of the session? I mean, clearly the anti-discrimination bill was something that you are excited about. But beyond any of that, was it significant transformational, as the speaker said?
Transformational is transformational. And, you know, there were some good spots and some horrendous spots in the session. And I would give it a C.
Raining on the parade. We're just having a great conversation, Jim. Jeez.
Why you were, Greg.
Why C? What was C about it? What made it not
the
get above
biggest
it?
Issue facing the legislature, the most important issue, health care for 123,000 people who have been waiting now for a year and a half, as the governor went into dithering mode for 2 years before the decision had to be made, and set up commission after committee commission. Then we went through the whole legislature while they studied it and did nothing. And then this was going to be the one. We were going to get to it. This is going to happen. And guess what happened? Nothing. Oh, no. Wait a minute. They started a commission. And that commission is made up of all the Republicans in the legislature who now have a concurrent resolution which says they can all get together and figure out what they're going to do about what they've been talking about doing for 3 years. So that was a little bit of a bad grade, but a lot of good things happened as well.
I want to pick a shot clock here. Come on, I think this guy...
Mr. Speaker, I do want to give you a chance, obviously, to respond to that, because, of course, you received a lot of attention, your share of criticism,
sure,
for first refusing to give the bill, Senate Bill 164, which was Governor Herbert's Healthy Utah Plan, to give it an airing. I know you've talked about that, but help us understand your thinking. What you've said is that holding a vote would just be political pageantry. You didn't want that.
Here's a scenario. When you have we call the House the arena. I mean, the Senate, they get to be the House of Lords, the old and the slow. They get to be very quiet, and they don't really deliberate much. They just get to yell yay or nay. The House is a very, very different place. There are vast opinions. There are passionate positions taken. And when you look at the 75-member House, 63 are Republican. Political science will tell you, when I arrived 13 years ago, there were 54 Republicans. So if you have 9 seats that are recent and newly held by Republicans, that broadens the political perspective. It doesn't make it more conservative. It means that different districts and diverse opinions are being represented in that Republican caucus. You can't walk in as a member of leadership and say to 63 members of a caucus or 75 members of a House, this is the position, here's the playbook, let's go do it. You have to have a vetting of all the information, and you have to hope that good information drives good decisions. Well, at the beginning of this process, as this leadership team was voted on, elected, so back in early December, we have within the Republican caucus and within the House incredible experience. We have physicians, for physicians that don't see Medicaid expansion the same way. Some are very supportive of it. Some are very skeptical of expanding into that space. You have insurance executives. You have healthcare administrators. And we decided to let all that information be shared as passionately as possible. And then when you asked for a pulse of that caucus, we saw that our deepest well of support was for, in December, a wait-and-see mode.
But, Mr. Speaker, that's not a public airing of the issue. Well, that's an issue inside of the Republican Party.
Well, there's a process there. And much of what you saw in that caucus discussion came from the task force, the health care reform task force that had been meeting for 2 years. There's a lot of work, public hearings, and a lot of work that is the basis for these discussions that are going forward. You have to, if you
want to. But I don't understand. Obviously, you had counted the votes. You knew you weren't going to get it, wasn't going to pass. Why not just let it? I mean, were you worried about amendments? Were you worried it may go in a direction that it,
so
you
So let's do the rest of the story.
Yeah.
So that's where we began. You had the largest well of support for a wait and see. You had another group that were in the let's find some moderated positions, somewhere within the 0 to 100% poor. 100% poor is government speak for poor. Okay, that's what you're talking about. And then you had the Healthy Utah group, which was actually the smallest group of votes. There was a migration, Doug. We had, because when I met with the governor to say, Governor, we don't have the support for Healthy Utah, the message was meant to be, let's find that common ground where there is support. There was a doubling down of, no, I want a hearing for that bill. And that's where you got my quote of, why would we have a hearing for something that isn't there? But we don't have to make that hypothetical because, as the governor insisted, instead of looking at the common ground that I want a hearing, we had the hearing. And Healthy Utah died, 9 votes against, 4 votes for.
Yeah.
And then you went to the floor and some said, well, that's just a committee vote. If you got it on the floor, it would do better. Representative Chavez Houck looked to substitute the Utah Cares bill into Healthy Utah. That motion or that bill died, 52 votes against, 22 votes for, with one person missing. So what I was trying to explain about if it's for the purpose of passing legislation, we need to have hearings and floor debates on areas of common ground. There was this insistence on the very hearings and floor debate, which we ultimately did have, of which didn't pass. So that's where
interesting.
We are. But we did move. We came to a place from a wait and see to a place where we felt Representative Dunnigan's bill would provide coverage for those in the 0 to 100% of the poverty level. And that was one of those we think good or perfect can't be the enemy of good. We thought that was good, and we thought that was a defensible place to be.
The governor said you were hunkering down. He said you had a bunker mentality. He said that inhibits the ability to resolve issues. It was interesting to see the relationship between you and the governor. What do you make of that, and how do you respond to the idea that you were hunkering down and you had a bunker mentality?
Well, I think, you know, we have everybody has their opinion, and it's obviously shared. Any negotiation in public policy, people are going to start on one side and then there's going to be another side. And what you usually see is a migration to that, again, common ground. This is the only public policy debate that I have seen where you had a large well, like I've said, of wait and see, move past wait and see to a moderated position. There was a bill by Senator Alan Christensen from the Senate that was a portion of the 100% of the 0 to 100% poverty. We moved past that to the complete coverage gap of 0 to 100%. The governor never moved off of 138% going into the area that the federal government already pays for. So I would argue that if you're looking for common ground, you have to come to that center as
come
well.
To you. Yeah. Senator DeBacus, what do you make of where it ended up? I mean, on the last afternoon of the session, the governor said that legislative leaders would be spending the months working out a solution. The idea is hopefully to call a special session to resolve this. What do you think is going to come of all of this now?
Look, let's put this into perspective. The federal government has a check. It's $647,700,000 by 2021. There it is. Utah taxpayers, you paid that. That's your share to pay for low-income people to get health care. There's your check. You paid for it. It's like the tax refund you get in the mail. And what our good friends have said is, you know what? We don't want that tax refund. We're going to show them in Washington. We don't want – that's sure going to show them. Other states are taking their check, but Utah's decided, you know what? On principle, the federal government could implode. Everything could die. everything could go wrong, so we're going to show them we don't want their stinking money, even though it's our money. That's what we're talking about. We should have taken full Medicaid expansion from day one. That was plan one. We went through this machinations. Finally, the governor came up with Healthy Utah. It's not nearly as good as full Medicaid, but I said, all right, if that's where we'll go, that's where we'll go. Then others came up with Frail Utah, which covers 9,000 people instead of 125,000. And for the first couple of years, ends up costing the state more to cover nine than we would have taken if we would have taken the ripped up jack. And then you had the big crowd that said, hey, we're not doing anything. We're really going to show those feds what we're going to do. And people in desperate need of health care over the last 3 years, while we've been dithering and looking and the governor's been studying, are just sitting on the sidelines praying, hoping, believing, thinking that one day we're going to actually act. So what happened in this session? We decided, yeah, we're going to have another study about all of this. Well, it's time to stop the study, and it's time for action, and I think we all are on that point at this moment.
You know, the session ended at midnight. Were you there? I mean, how are you this energetic? I mean, I'm barely awake here.
That's a good point. Oh. I want to ask you about the anti-discrimination bill.
We should say, if I can interrupt, Greg and I love each other. We've worked together for a long time, and we're able to – he's a boxer, and sometimes he lets me really have it. This is nothing but two guys who really, really, at least on my part, I really enjoy Greg.
Yeah, we get
and
along
I enjoy
well.
Going back and forth.
I just
forth,
don't know where so. You're getting all this energy. I don't understand.
Let me ask about the anti-discrimination bill. Mr. Speaker, you never had a chance – hadn't had a chance before all of this to vote for the bill. I mean, it didn't make it out of the Senate in the three or I think maybe four times it had been proposed. The big question is, did the LDS Church's support of this, did it sway you? And would you have voted for it had you had the chance before?
Doug, there were a couple things that have happened recently that have really changed the landscape. One was the Supreme Court rejection of hearing Utah's case. And so when the constitutional amendment was thrown out by a federal judge and then that appeal was not heard, there were some realities to that policymakers were able to absorb and understand. The church stepping forward, the LDS Church stepping forward and talking about treating people with respect and dignity and this common ground that could be arrived at, it absolutely, I think, was a game changer in this debate. You had the issues that have happened with the constitutional amendment being ruled unconstitutional. But then with the church's leadership, it truly did open hearts, open minds, and I think that was a big deal. What I have always hoped is that, you know, anti-discrimination, religious liberty, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think we treat each other with dignity and respect, whether it's the church you attend on Sunday or if you do, or the makeup of your household. Let's treat each other like human beings and with love and respect. I've always hated that we've always siloed these concepts. And so I was glad to see a legislation that was more encompassing of all those sentiments.
Senator, you've been a big supporter of this idea for some time now. How much of a how proud do you feel right now? How much of a success? How are you thinking about it? You must be – I mean, I'm sure you want to move this forward. We can talk about that. But just your general impressions now.
It was the hardest thing I've ever been involved in my life. It was an extraordinary time. I mean, the LGBT community started talks in 2009 after Proposition H, which really created a terrible feeling in our community. And we have built slowly and carefully toward this moment. And there was just hours and hours and hours of talks. And I'm profoundly grateful for our LGBT community and for the LDS Church and for the other people. We all gave for the broader good. There are a lot of gay people that are terribly uncomfortable with what happened. And I know for Greg and members of the House and the Senate, there were people that were outraged at what happened. But in a general sense, I think Utah did what Utah does best, and that is we sat at the table, we sat and we sat and we argued and we had creepy lawyers everywhere. And we went through it hour after hour until we came to things that we could compromise and live with. And I'm tremendously proud of our whole community.
What's next, do you think, in this issue? I mean, there's a public accommodations bill that you're drafting, thinking about. You're just going to put that on hold for now?
I got to spend this week reading all the bills I voted on last week, so I'm not really prepared to move forward and talk about next year, Don.
Is that a strategic decision?
Really, I don't know where we're going. We'll move forward.
Oh, I love watching you
with
squirm.
With liberty and justice
keep
for
going.
All.
Keep dodging. Keep moving. Duck, weave.
All right, I'll push you later. Mr. Speaker, let me ask you finally, what was the biggest disappointment for you for this session, the thing that you feel like you didn't get to?
Well, I'll tell you what. I am disappointed that we didn't find the common ground on the Medicaid expansion debate. I think that what you just heard described is a formula. There had to be as many concerns and as many preferred routes of that legislation and how it would look with anti-discrimination and religious liberties as we've had with Medicaid expansion. We did not have the kind of willingness to not let perfect be the enemy of good. That is the problem. And that disappoints me. I've been saying that we have this unique situation. We have a governor and a Senate and a House, and it takes three to tango in this dance. And I really felt that we had moved far, oceans, from where we began in December. There really was I'll give you a number. If 30 lawmakers said wait and see in the House caucus, 4 were left. And that meant 26 had come to a place where they could provide health care for those that didn't have it. And the idea that we weren't able to ever get there, it is a great disappointment to me.
Final thoughts, Jim DeBacchus. What was your greatest disappointment? I mean, it sounds like health care.
Yeah, no question about health care being the greatest disappointment. And I hope in the broad picture that we can get away from ideological solutions and more down to brass tacks. I see one of the faults of our legislature is that we're just wrapped up in too many, this is the Constitution, and the Constitution would want me to do this, even if it's preposterous on the face of it, kind of solutions sometimes. So I would hope that we could get to pragmatic solutions. Greg's going to come at me, so I'm going to give a 10-second example.
Shot clock, Doug.
There was a bill that would have taken away the $138 million that Utah gets in federal funding for breakfast and lunch school programs for our poorest children. There was a bill that said, we don't want their money. That's a bad thing. That's putting, even if you believe the Constitution prohibits that, to say, I'm going to stick with that constitutional interpretation, even though we're going to have hungry kids in the classroom. So that's what I'm talking about.
Quick response.
Yeah, I want everyone to know, you have your underpinnings, your constitutional understanding and all of that. But let's not mistake some of the decisions that we make. Policy intertwines very well with those beliefs and those core beliefs. On the issue of federal dollars, the state just pays. These aren't federal dollars that the state receives. When you talk about the funds that come to hospitals and those that represent or that Senator DeBacchus describes, the state only pays the bills. We had a $22 million shortfall in the existing Medicaid programs, of which when you have to make those budgets in social services, you're finding incredibly important programs that you have to cut to go and fix and pay for the overages that you didn't expect to happen. When you're a policymaker that have to, in a state that has to balance budgets where we're not printing money like the feds, but you have to balance those budgets, it's not that you throw out the bad ideas and only fund the good ideas. When you see the growth of Medicaid and you're talking about expanding that and the state and taxpayers pay it, if it goes over what you've budgeted, something has to give. And those areas that give are not good. And that weighs heavily on policymakers. And so this idea that all these hundreds of millions of dollars are going to come to the state, why wouldn't we take it? This is not a straight trade going on. The state only pays its portion. And that portion is growing incredibly fast under existing Medicaid. And there is worry about how you sustain that and how you can do it responsibly and have the state keep its commitments. There is a strong policy discussion that has been occurring and needs to continue about how we make sure we safeguard that process.
We'll leave it there. Representative Greg Hughes is a Republican Speaker of the Utah House of Representatives. He serves Draper's District 51. Mr. Speaker, thanks very much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Senator Jim DeBacus, the Democrat Minority Caucus Manager, serves Salt Lake City's District Number 2. Senator, thanks to you as well.
It's a pleasure to be here. I don't know if we really need Greg, but I enjoyed being here.
I'm half asleep. I'm not sure I'm here. So.
We're live in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. And we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. It's Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're live at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. We're talking about this year's legislative session, which ended a few hours ago. We've had with us Speaker Greg Hughes. We had Senator Jim DeBacus joining us now. Are some reporters and observers of the process. Robert Gerke is with us, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Holly Richardson is with us, conservative blogger, former state representative. Her blog is called Holly on the Hill. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Marianne Martindale is with us, executive director of the Alliance for a Better Utah. It's an organization that advocates for progressive issues at the legislature. Marianne, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, general impressions I wanted to start with, I guess. Robert, in your article this morning about the legislature, you said that this dispute between the House and the governor over health care, you called it trench warfare. Does it characterize the relationship in some way? What do you make of that relationship?
Well, I think it does, because you have this chasm between the two where neither of them can budge. And the issue is you've got the House that'll go to 100% but won't go a step farther, and you've got Governor Herbert, who's at 138% of poverty. Now, let's put this into perspective real quick. 100% of poverty for a family of four is about $12,000, a little less than that. So we're talking about very poor people. But they can't move off of that. Governor Herbert can't come down from 138% because the federal restrictions won't let him. The state will lose that big check that Senator DeBacus was talking about. And the House won't go over 100% because they want to keep control, constraints on this program. And so neither of them it's really almost an intractable position. And you've got, Speaker Hughes kind of hit it on the head, I think, when he said it takes three to tango, because you do need the House, you do need the Senate, you do need the governor, but there's a fourth partner in the federal government that he's leaving out of this equation. And you can have Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire, and Gene Kelly dancing with his three partners, and you've got Frankenstein here that has these sort of big lumbering feet, and it can't move quickly, it can't move nimbly, and it's that's where they are, and that's really the challenge that they're going to be facing between now and July, because unless something changes in that whole dynamic, they're really going to have a hard time moving this forward, I think.
Holly, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. That was one of my comments with Speaker Hughes on my blog about, not only can he take some punches, but he can throw them too.
Yeah.
And I think you saw that during the session, especially on that issue. And I don't think it's because they hate poor people, like it's sometimes characterized, right? But they're also looking for they have a fiduciary responsibility, meaning they have to be able to balance the budget across the board. So everybody can come up with one perfect program to fund, but then you have everything else. And so if things start to get out of whack, then where are you going to take the money from? Are you going to take it from education? Are you going to take it from roads? Where are you going to take it from? And I think that's where they're at right now.
Marianne?
Yeah, I think that's a good characterizations by both of them. I kept thinking of this saying that what happens when an immovable object meets an unstoppable force? It's a trick question. One of them has to give. But it truly felt this session that Healthy Utah or any form of Medicaid expansion was one side was an unmovable object and one was an unstoppable force. And we just couldn't get any traction either direction.
The anti-discrimination bill, obviously very significant for all kinds of different reasons. I wanted to ask you, how did you think when the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints came out and made the announcement that it was going to support this legislation. Was it a game changer? I mean, that seems like a very obvious question, but there was still a bit of pushback, a bit of resistance. I mean, did that, as I think as the speaker said, transform the issue? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely did. And I think Senator Back has kind of hit on another dynamic in that the Supreme Court's decision not to hear this challenge to Utah's case on same-sex marriage kind of changed the dynamic of that. This is a bill that's been up there for a number of years, and I spoke with Senate now Mayor McAdams about this when he was sponsoring it, and he had had meetings with the LDS Church at the time, and the sides were intractable because there was this sort of anchor or this cloud of this case sort of hanging over it. And so neither side was, what they were fighting at the time. And so they didn't want to move on this non-discrimination stuff. With that resolved, I think it cleared the playing field a little bit. The church took a step forward, huge step forward. I mean, if you talk to Senator Urquhart, he was the guy who sponsored this bill. Mm-hmm. You ask him if this would have happened without them, and he says absolutely no way. I mean, mm-hmm. it was absolutely vital to it.
But it was interesting. I heard that the church had something like 3 or 4 lobbyists up on the Hill pushing that issue.
They do.
Absolutely.
Is that no big deal? That's
it's
just
normal.
They
call them the home teachers.
Yep.
That's
true.
And they're up there, and they had the home teachers up there, and they had their attorneys. They have attorneys from Curtin McConkie that work on these issues, and they met. They were very involved in the actual wordsmithing of this legislation.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they call them lobbyists. I think they call them gentle encouragers.
Do they have to wear the name badges? That's what
they,
I want to
They
know.
Probably do have to wear badges.
I want to jump in here, too, and say it's not just that the LDS Church said at the end of January that they supported legislation, even though there wasn't a specific piece at that point. And then in their press conference where they said, we support, in fact, they changed it. They said, the LDS Church supports this piece of legislation specifically.
And that was a big deal.
They had some pushback last time on the immigration issue, and people were saying, well, they didn't really speak for the church. They've kind of gone rogue. I think they tried to be very, very clear. But one of the other dynamics is that this piece of legislation has those religious liberties in them. And previous pieces didn't include that component. And so I think that's another piece as well. So, yeah, I think, was it a game changer? Absolutely, there's no question. I mean, my first response was, well, that's 100% passage right there.
but it wasn't necessarily.
It, you know, there's still people who disagree, and there's still people who push back. And, you know, I have a senator that I talked to, and he said, he's LDS, active LDS. He said, I don't always follow the prophet. Okay, right? But it certainly had a big influence.
It's interesting to hear Senator DeBacchus, he'll forgive me, sounding cagey, though, on the question of what happens next. Public accommodations, right now they want to score this as a victory for sure, but it's not entirely resolved. What's next?
I think that's a hard question because it really does come. I think we need to see how this bill plays out, how once this becomes law, sort of what other things fall out and where we see where there still may be conflict. Because at this point, I mean, this is the product of far longer than 8 years of legislation, but actually almost a very specific bill that's been tweaked and worked for eight sessions in a row. And it took that long to get this passed. Now it's a little bit of a step back. Let's see how this implements. Let's see how it affects property owners, business owners, and so forth, and see if there's a need to go further. And there was certainly no way that anything further was going to pass this year. So there's a certain caution to, let's do one step, and then let's revisit it. Let's reevaluate where we are and see what we need to do further.
And I think on both sides, right? I mean, I think on the conservative side as well, that the concern is that it's protected some institutional organizations like the LDS Church and the Boy Scouts, but it doesn't protect individuals. And so there's the companion piece of legislation as well. But I think that's where some of the concern still lies.
And public accommodations probably is the next step. It's just a question of when you take that step. And I think Marianne hit it. You have to kind of wait and see how this one goes. And if we thought this one was hard, wait till you get to public accommodations. Mm-hmm. There are so many moving pieces to that question, way beyond housing and employment like this bill covered.
And there was a much further religious protection bill, too, that ended up getting buried.
Right.
So they did try to go farther on even that side.
It's interesting you're hearing this. The governor said this, and some lawmakers mentioned that this is going to be a precedent for this issue around the country. And I'm wondering if you think, I think it was referred to by Representative Brad D. of Ogden, that it was a Utah solution. I think he's the one that put it that way. I think a few people said that. I mean, do you think that there's something particularly unique about that, you know, the Mormon gay sort of alliance that came to play that can offer some guidance for the country?
I think it depends which level you look at that. I think the actual on-the-ground bill language probably doesn't translate state to state. If you want to look at it from the idea that these two sides came together, that people were able to collaborate on some legislation where no one got everything they wanted, everybody got the piece that they were comfortable with and we move forward with, then yeah, I think it's a model for the state. But it certainly is – Utah is unique. Not every state is going to have a – Mormon church that is so strong in the influence that they have, and then the LGBT community. So other states that maybe don't have a strong unique religious base, that's not going to be able to translate directly.
There are a number of states, though, that do have a really strong religious component to them, right? I mean, whether it's an LDS church or a Baptist church or, you know, whatever it is across the nation. I mean, I think there are a lot of states who are trying to tackle these issues at this point. I think the lieutenant governor yesterday at the bill signing said something that I thought was just really apropos. And he said, I look forward to the day when this type of legislation is not necessary for all the right reasons. And I think that it's still troubling that this type of legislation is necessary for the wrong reasons, right? But agree with our lieutenant governor that hopefully we'll see a day where it's no longer necessary for all the right reasons.
And I'll just say, I mean, I don't want to be a wet blanket on this, but there are roughly three dozen states that already have religious freedom laws. There are a number of states that already have anti-discrimination protections for gay and lesbians. So it's not groundbreaking in that respect. I guess you could say that in the sense that the two sides kind of joined together, right, and ran these as, you know, parallel tracks, right? Right. I mean, you needed two wheels on the bicycle, perhaps. So in that respect, it may be unique. But in terms of the outcomes, we've seen this happen in other states.
It's not, I think, a lot of people were surprised that not much happened in terms of air quality.
Yeah.
And Robert Gerke, you quoted a Democratic Representative Brad King in your story, who complained that with all the momentum from last year and all the crappy air from last year, that lawmakers, he says, are passing fewer bills, spending less and less money on the issue.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think air quality is one of those issues where if it's not hitting you in the face, you don't think about it. And I think this year, honestly, the fact that the air was pretty good for most of the year kind of diminished some of the clamoring for air quality legislation. There was a lot of money to be spent this year, and not all that much of it went to air quality. There was this request from the governor of $20 million he wanted to retrofit these buses to make them cleaner. They didn't really get much of that. There was a program to try to incentivize people to change out their dirty, polluting equipment. That got some money at the very end, but not as much as they wanted. There was money that they wanted for air quality research. That got sort of short shrift. And so the advocates for improved air quality were left kind of disappointed, I think. There was a bill that passed that lets the state implement more stringent regulations on air quality, sort of locally oriented restrictions. And so that was significant. That was one that was a high priority for the air quality advocates. But, yeah, as Representative King mentioned, they came away sort of unimpressed. And, you know, they were not blown away by what happened.
Marianne, what did you make of that? Did it surprise you at all that almost
No, I'll quote another Democratic representative, Patrice Arendt. She said the best thing for air quality legislation is really bad air. Mm-hmm. As soon as it cleared out, the attention turned other ways. And frankly, probably with some other reason, too. I mean, we've seen years where maybe air quality was the issue. That certainly was not the issue this year. There were some really important issues up there that they were going to be dealing with. And so when that didn't rise to the top, because we weren't breathing, sucking in this really horrible gray-brown air, that it just kind of fell off. So there were, you know, as Robert said, there were a couple things that passed. There also weren't nearly the number of bills as we've seen in past either. Last year, I think it was like 20-something bills.
That's
so
right.
Maybe proportionally, we may have actually passed the same number of bills.
I want to ask you about the money picture, what you're all seeing that way. $750 million in new revenue. Robert Gerke, lawmakers raised taxes this year.
Yeah, it's a little bit shocking. We live in a very Republican state, right? We're supposed to be fiscally conservative, and there was nearly $750 million in new revenue this year. And they raised taxes, a $75 million property tax increase. It's about $50 per homeowner. And then there was this gas tax increase, it's a nickel up front, and then we'll be indexed. That's going to be about $40 million per year. And so, you know, they're on pace. If the trajectory for economic growth continues, they're on pace to grow government by another $1 billion next year. And so that's fairly extraordinary. Now, they said the reason they needed to do that is because they had all these transportation needs that weren't getting funded. that had been sort of put on the back burner during the recession. They started cutting back on that, so they needed to get serious about that, and so they needed some dedicated revenue. But yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
That seems like the thing that the speaker was most proud of, almost, movement on transportation infrastructure.
It's been a big issue. It's been talked about for a number of years. I think it's been 17 years since we've increased the gas tax. And they said during that time, inflation has eaten away at the money they get. There was a strong feeling that that was something that needed to be addressed now. And frankly, with the economy recovering the way it has, with gas prices kind of going down, they felt like it was a good time to do it.
Education funding, what did you all make of that? Marianne, 4% increase in per pupil spending, $500 million for public ed and higher ed. A lot of people didn't think it would get there. It did.
It's actually higher than I expected them to get.
Really?
When the governor and of course we always want more. I mean, I think everybody can agree that public education has a lot of issues. I don't know that an extra 1% is going to solve all those issues. I think you need to go to a lot deeper dive on that issue. But the governor said, I'd like 6.5%. Well, whenever you're negotiating, you don't go in and buy a house, say, I'm going to give you the more money than you're asking for your house. And so everybody looked at that who was maybe an insider and knew that when he says 6.5, he's probably hoping to get 3 or 4%. And so when they landed on 4, I think, most people felt like that was actually pretty fair. It was a point and a half higher than last year. They had 2.5% last year. Previous years, they haven't gotten anything. It's been flat during the recession. So and all in all, it wasn't horrible in terms of that amount of money. I mean, it's hard because, of course, we look at it and we think we need hundreds of millions of dollars infused in here, but that's a separate issue and a separate money.
Holly?
Right. I mean, I think the 4% increase is actually pretty significant. And, sometimes it gets drowned out of that it could have been more. Well, yeah, and a lot of things could have been more, right, if you take away from other areas. But I think 4% is generous. $500 million is not a small amount. And I think to Marianne's point, I think it's deeper. There are deeper issues than money, right? I mean, that's one of the discussions that's ongoing on the Hill with education every year is how much disruptive innovation do you do? Do you stay with brick and mortar? Is it always the same? The argument between traditional schools and charter schools, I mean, that's ongoing. Mm-hmm. But for the financing, $500 million is good.
We're probably noteworthy for the people in this room that the higher ed only got 2%, and that probably is going to translate to about a 3 to 4% tuition increase for you guys next year, so save your pennies.
Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We have Holly Richardson with us, a conservative blogger, former state lawmaker. Her blog is called Holly on the Hill. We also have Marianne Martindale with us, executive director for the Alliance for a Better Utah. And we'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. We're in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what happened and what didn't in the 2015 legislative session. We're here at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. We have with us Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. We have Holly Richardson, who blogs at Holly on the Hill. Marianne Martindale, executive director of Alliance for a Better Utah. Robert Gerke, the legislature invested, $15 million to reform the prison system. As you wrote, they reduced sentences for some drug crimes. They focused on rehabilitation, reducing recidivism. Was this a big deal?
It was a big deal, and it's something that's been going on for a number of months. The Pew Institute came in and tried to work with the state to try to – and it's going on across the country. The fact of the matter is they're looking at rebuilding the state prison. They want to keep it sort of the same size as the one now. And so the way to keep the prison from bursting at the seams is to try to stop sending so many people back to prison. And so you've got all of these people with drug issues. About 80% of the people in prison have a drug issue, and about two-thirds of them are back in prison after they within a short period of time of getting out. So they wanted to try to stop that revolving door. The way they did it is, over in recent years in my lifetime, we've actually gotten really hard on crime, on drug crime. And so they're trying to step back from that a little bit and say, instead of locking people up for drug crimes, let's rehabilitate them, try to keep them out of prison, give them a support network when they get out. It's going to be a significant challenge. It's paid some benefits in other states that have done it. And the long-term goal is to try to bend the curve on the prison population a little bit and keep that from
is that a sea change? Because, I mean, ideologically, this really works well for the right, this being tough on crime, drug crime, those kinds of things. Does it mean that we're shifting away from that?
I think it does mean that. And there was a statistic before this whole thing started that in the previous 3 years we'd created something like 75 new felonies and only taken 3 off the books. So you can't continue on that trajectory without locking up more and more and more people for longer and longer and longer periods of time. So you've got to stop locking people up for as long, and when they get out, you've got to give them a support network and give them the rehabilitative tools they need. One piece of this, though, that fell through was they were counting on the Medicaid expansion that fell apart to sort of give these people mental health support, give them some of the support structure they need, because you get out of prison, you're in poverty, you've got no insurance. What are you going to do? You can't get the medications you need for mental health issues. You can't get the rehabilitative services you need. And so that piece, sort of that plank of this whole thing, kind of got pulled out.
Marianne, you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, that was the most disappointing about it. I mean, it was really an exciting initiative, and I don't want to understate how big of a shift this is in terms of criminal justice policy. And it is part of a whole nationwide look at this. We've seen our own Representative Chaffetz and Senator Mike Lee talking about this nationally. You know, we're having to reevaluate this. We have prisons full of nonviolent, low-level offenders and reoffenders and parole violators. And we don't have room for them. And it's so whether it's an ideological shift from the right, and I don't know, I can't speak for the right.
It's the libertarian view.
Yeah. Or whether it's actually a look to the economic benefit of this, because there's also a huge expense to incarcerating people. And, you know, I think anyone at this table and probably anywhere would agree there are people who have to be incarcerated. But we have to look at how many people, and should we be filling these prisons with people who could benefit better from other services that are available outside? And that's the piece that was disappointing, because a lot of those services are tied up into Medicaid expansion.
Holly Richardson, medical marijuana falls one vote short in the Senate. That seems
lucky.
what do you make of that? Just the conversation, the debate, the effort.
So personally, what I make of it is that bill was not ready for prime time, for one thing. For another thing, I think people are willing to have the conversation about what it would look like, but they are not comfortable largely with just kind of this open-ended. I mean, really, the bill was not as well drafted as I had hoped it would be. The first draft put it under the Tax Commission, and so it would have been Commissioner John Valentine who was supposed to run this whole program, and he testified, well, I do taxes, right? I don't do this other stuff. So, I mean, kudos to Mark Madsen, Senator Madsen, for bringing it forward and starting the conversation. And I think there is a sense that we want to help people who are suffering. We want to make sure that there are options that are available to them. But we also, especially from my perspective on the right, don't want to open the door so wide that we have a whole host of other problems that are either unanticipated or are anticipated, but we kind of, you know, turn the other way. So it doesn't surprise me that it did not pass.
Just sort of to reiterate what Holly said, there was a pretty good concept for tracking this seed to sale, you know, from you're growing the plants and you track them all the way along. But again, what they failed to do this time is he put the Department of Professional Licensing was supposed to license the dispensaries and grow houses, but he never met with Doppel before he brought the bill out.
Right.
The Department of Public Safety was supposed to oversee the regulatory scheme. Never met with Public Safety before he brought the bill out. It came out very late in the session. He was scrambling to try to get, you know, revisions done as he held these meetings. And it just wasn't ready. I mean, he didn't bring it out early enough. So it's teed up for next year. There's going to be a discussion of it, I'm sure, during the interim. And it was sort of groundbreaking for Utah, even though we're sandwiched between Colorado and Nevada that both have these sorts of programs. For Utah to actually take something on like this was pretty groundbreaking.
Firing squad coming back. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time with that. Was that... Marianne, what do you want to say about that?
Well, I'm vehemently opposed to the death penalty. I think we need to have a discussion about that and why it is that as a state we're executing people. We have a duty to provide security and safety and to incarcerate people who are violent. I don't think that duty extends to killing them. So That's a pretty hard line for that for me on that one. Not a fan of the firing squad. I wish they would have talked about the guillotine. Maybe that would have made the conversation be a little bit more blunt.
The Republican Party is challenging, of course, this compromise legislation over the Count My Vote initiative. Robert Gerke, what happened there?
Nothing. Basically, you know, there was this big push to try to delay it, or to there was a constitutional amendment proposal that would have given the party just sort of carte blanche to kind of pick candidates how they want. There was this proposal to send it, you know, if nobody in a primary gets more than 50%, they'd send it back to the delegates. None of those ended up passing. They're going to let this run its course in courts. And mm-hmm. it appears right now in 2016 we'll have mm-hmm. this sort of count my vote signature gathering rubric that's been put in place.
I'm wondering if there's – I'm sure there's plenty of stuff we've missed. Give me a sense, finally, all of you. Marianne, I'll start with you. Some people are saying it was a groundbreaking session, a lot moved. Some saying it wasn't, as Senator Dukakis said, not quite up to snuff. What's your sense of it? What did they miss? What do you worry about?
I'd probably
still?
Give it a C. I mean, I was really frustrated with the intransigence over the health care issue. That's, you know, it's something that's not new. We've been dealing with this, working to this point for a long time, and then to see such inability to find something that worked for everybody, and an inability to even really try to find that middle ground, which it seemed was pretty clear, that was frustrating. That one really put a damper on the session for me.
Holly, what about you?
Well, I give the session like an A-. I thought they did a really great job. I thought they addressed many issues. I understand the frustration on the healthcare issue, but I think it is a really big, important fiduciary issue that they've really got to address. But the one thing that I think that they missed consistently this session is kind of the protectionism we sometimes see from some industries to potential competitors. I'm thinking specifically of Tesla, right? That should have been an easy fix, but we had some heavy-duty lobbying from automakers and auto dealers, and they won't let Tesla operate, right, because it's different. So welcome to the 21st century. Let's get on the ball and do it again, you know, next year. But that was a disappointment.
Robert Gerke, I won't make you give a grade, but give me a sense of how significant you think this session was.
You know, I think there were a tremendous number of big issues this session, and there didn't seem to be sort of some of the petty squabbling that we get over little issues. You know, it seemed like things moved fairly smoothly. Now, Healthy Utah sucked a lot of the air out of the room, but there was a significant bill that didn't get a lot of attention dealing with water infrastructure funding. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a big one going forward. You know, there were, you know, obviously the state dog bill didn't pass, and I think everybody's really broken up about that. You know,
we still have a Zion curtain.
We'll be back next
year. You can cow share, though.
You can cow share.
That's right. We didn't get to cow sharing. I thought we might, but we didn't.
So, you know, they took on some pretty weighty issues, and you know, there was the political will on transportation tax. That was a huge lift. That one's been a long time coming. And so it was a significant substantive session. And I guess if I had to give him a grade, I'd give him an incomplete right now and see what happens with Healthy Utah.
It's Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. Holly Richardson blogs at Holly on the Hill. Marianne Martindale, Executive Director of Alliance for a Better Utah. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks to those of us here at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.